Your film is now ready to be shown.
Good morning. I'm Justin Hendricks, editor of Tech Policy Press. We publish news, analysis, and perspectives on issues at the intersection of tech and democracy. This year, Tech Policy Press is hosting 9 reporting fellows. These individuals, who are located around the world, from India to Spain to Brazil to the U.S. and beyond, bring a variety of experiences and expertise to their work. One of those fellows is Anika Collier-Navaroli. Anika is an award-winning writer, lawyer, and researcher focused on the intersections of technology, media, policy, and human rights. And she's an assistant professor of professional practice at Columbia University in its Graduate School of Journalism. For her fellowship, Anika is conducting a series of discussions like the one you'll hear today that are intended to help us imagine possible futures for tech and tech policy, for democracy, and for society beyond the moment we're in. Here's Anika to introduce the latest episode in the series, which she's dubbed Through to Thriving.
Hey, y'all. Thank you for joining us for another episode of Through to Thriving. This is a special podcast series where I'm talking to a bunch of brilliant tech policy folks about how we can build futures beyond our current moment. And today we are going to be talking about protecting our privacy with Chris Gilliard. Chris, would you mind introducing yourself to our listeners?
My name is Chris Gilliard. I am the co-director of the Critical Internet Studies Institute and the author of the forthcoming book, Luxury Surveillance.
I'm glad you mentioned your book, because we're definitely going to get into that and talk about some of the things that you are working on. But we are here today, again, to talk a little bit about protecting our privacy. Our viewers do not know this. They don't see this, but I can actually see your face right now, which, as I said, wow, I've never seen your face before, because you are a notoriously private person, yes?
Yeah, absolutely. I do my best.
Can you tell me a little bit about what it means and how it is to be so online while also maintaining your privacy?
It is difficult, you know, because I think that there's an imperative driven by tech companies, you know, but a lot of us have helped drive that imperative that we're supposed to give away everything online, supposed to put pictures of ourselves, talk about our hobbies, you know, show our pets, our families, all those things. I generally resist those things. I have some ideological reasons for doing so, but it's difficult.
I would love to talk to you about your ideological reasons for resisting, but I also would just say, as a personal point, I'm incredibly jealous, right? I think one of the things in my life that I've hated the most about the past couple of years is how visible I have had to be and how much my face has been in various different places as someone who is also notoriously a private person and didn't have my face on the internet ever for the many, many years, and now have to be in this place. It's a very, very interesting sort of spot, as you said, it's sort of imperative to give away everything online. And I would love to hear a little bit more about your ideological resistance to that. Tell me more about that.
Shorthand, I would say that I try whenever possible to not feed the machine. And so that means when I have an option, and sometimes you don't, you know, but when I have an option, I do not show my face, or I do not give away, you know, intimate details about myself, things like that.
Right.
You know, I was in the Washington Post. Willow Remus did a profile of me several years
ago. Right. Yes, I remember this.
It was quite the negotiation to get them to have pictures of me, but not pictures of my face. It was very difficult. But I do, whenever possible, I try to not feed the machine.
As someone who's also done a profile in the Washington Post, and my face has been everywhere on that, I remember seeing this and being so jealous and being like, oh, man, what kind of negotiation did you get?
The piece almost didn't run, you know, for that simple fact.
That's really funny. I think this not showing of your face in so many ways is such a power move, to be really honest with you, right? I remember I was working at a tech company that shall not be named, and I was really burnt out, and I had just decided, I'm not showing my face on camera anymore, right? And I just started showing up to meetings, no camera on. And I remember the sort of resistance that people had to that, right? And the sort of no one really wanted to say anything. No one wanted to be the person to be can we please invade your privacy and be inside of your house right now, right? While we're all working from home. But it is definitely a shifting of power dynamics to be able to be in that space.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm glad you brought that up, because the height of the pandemic really exacerbated some of the worst impulses there. You know, I thought of and have been thinking a lot about this in terms of educational technologies, right? Where remote proctoring services and things like that, we're forcing students to show images of their face and do room scans and all these other things. But, you know, during that time when we were all Zooming everything, you know, there even were different accounts, Twitter accounts, I think, and things like that, that would rate people's rooms.
Yes.
You know, and
the room raiders.
Yes. Yeah, we're telling everyone we had to have a ring light and all these things.
Yes.
And I thought that that was so problematic and so underinvestigated that, you know, we were being conditioned to accept the idea that strangers had a right to peer into our houses.
Yeah.
I mean, I think Gen AI is changing that now too, because now we're being told that we have to optimize our looks with Gen AI, which is like a kind of different kind of intrusion. But I really think these things need to be kind of more investigated.
I'm so glad you brought up this invasion of privacy in COVID, because I remember there were so many different points and so many different times when I was working that I was like, I don't really want to see your bed, right? Like, I don't, there were times where like people's partners would be in the back in like various states of dress and distress. And I would just be like, who okayed this, right? Like this sort of complete invasion and this sort of complete like resetting of norms, right? Like there was never a place where in which I would ever have coworkers, no offense to my coworkers, that would be in my house, right? Like that was, my home is sacred. Like that was my home. And yet we were in a space where like, these folks that would never be in my home were in my home every day. And that just felt so strange.
Yeah. And if you think about all the things that could be gleaned just from the background of individuals' settings, you know, because a lot of people don't have a dedicated space where they podcast or Zoom from.
Right.
You know? And so given the world we live in, you know, there's reasons why people wouldn't want everyone to have that kind of access. And there was a lot of work done to normalize that, I think, to our detriment.
Talking about learning from the backgrounds of people, I've talked about this on the podcast before, but one of my favorite things that I actually did during the pandemic when we were stuck inside of people's homes and were in, you know, all hands meetings inside of these tech companies is we would have to go inside of the CEOs and the executives' homes, right? Which were, you know, not, they were not the folks that you were mentioning that didn't have the separate place.
Yeah.
Working through, I will never forget this. Listen, and I know some folks who listen to this will remember this. We had a person at one place that we worked at that during the pandemic, we could have swore they were like at a spa, right? Just like the breeze blowing in the little curtain in the background while all of us, like people were like in alleyways, you know what I mean? Like huddled into a computer and like,
yeah,
like this like complete, I mean, the disparity that showed at that time, I think was just something that I think you said it's like, completely underinvestigated, right? The sort of like the complete disparity between who had the ability to have these, you know, amazing places that, you know, were dedicated to work and who were, you know, forced inside to let people stare at their homes. I haven't thought a lot about this. I appreciate you for bringing this up.
And that's a big part of the reason I started saying no is because I have the option to say no. And I felt, you know, I don't want to, you know, overstate my importance in any way. But I thought that if I can say no, I should say no because it gives other people the option that they say, well, there's, you know, there are some people who don't do it. Right. And here's some of the reasons why. So more and more when I was on being interviewed for podcasts or for television shows or whatever the case may have been, I would not show my face. And I just tried to establish it as a norm that gave people the permission to not do it if they didn't desire to.
Well, I appreciate you setting that standard. And I want to encourage all of our listeners that who want to follow your footsteps to go ahead and do that. I feel like we need to have a revolution of a camera off, a revolution over here. You may not be inside of my home, but you said you don't want to overstate your importance. But everybody listening to this podcast and myself, part of the reason why I wanted you to be on here is because you are very important in this space and you're a person who has helped, you know, shape our nomenclature and the way that we think and that we talk about tech policy. And you do that a lot by being online, right? Which I think I mentioned is like a kind of dichotomy between being extremely private, but then being, would you consider yourself very online or how online on a scale of, you know, an offline to very online would you consider yourself?
Well, that's an interesting question because I mainly don't have social media.
Okay.
I use Blue Sky. It used to be Twitter, but I mainly don't use social media. I've never had Instagram. I quit Facebook in 2016, 2015. Okay. You know, so if being online means being on platforms, I guess I'm not really. But I do spend a good chunk of my day, you know, reading and researching articles that I mainly kind of access through online. So,
right.
Yeah.
Right. And I think, so I see very much of your posting about the sort of reading and research that you're doing. And I think that's what I see is the consistent sort of, here is this thing that's in the news, or here is this thing that's happening in the world that you might not necessarily see. You might have seen it, but you also add, you know, your own commentary and your context to it. And bringing it sort of to the foreground in this space. And I think, you know, you have been one of the folks that people have constantly gone to see, like, what is happening in the space? What we should be thinking about? What should we be talking about? Where do you go to find all of your reading and your research? Because, I mean, there are times you'll post an article that I'm like, where did you find that? Like, that's interesting. And also, like, where did you get this from?
I mean, kind of everywhere, you know. I have a RSS feed. You know, I do check in on Blue Sky. I mean, I try to follow other people who are doing and saying interesting things. I do, unfortunately, still read some of the legacy media.
I mean, we all do, you know.
Yeah, I mean, we kind of have to.
It's kind of part of the job, right?
Yeah. I think there's been some incredible work by independent media, like 404, should shout out. ProPublica. There's so many and individual journalists, you know, Brian Merchant, you know, researchers like Adair. I have the ability, especially in the last 3 years, I've had the ability to spend a good chunk of my time every day reading and writing about this stuff in ways I don't think is mostly available to people, you know. And so, yeah,
it's your job.
Yeah. So I try to get, you know, I'm sources from outside the US, you know, rest of the world. I check Financial Times every day, you know. I mean,
okay, what can you tell me what you check every day? Like, is there like a rotation that you wake up in the morning and pull out, you know, the paper, or how do you do this?
I check my RSS feed.
You said you had to get used to
it. I use Feedly. Okay. I mean, it's a little bit problematic. Okay.
Everything's problematic.
Yeah. I mean, I also have Apple News. Okay. And I have like a variety of terms that I set up alerts for. You know, I still use Google Alerts. I have a whole kind of system set up, and then I just, part of what I do when I get up, it's not the first thing I do.
I was going to say, is that like the first, open your eyes and it's like, all right, tech policy, what's going on? No,
right?
You have a life. Okay.
It's a little bit healthier. I go for a walk first.
Okay. Okay. We love a healthy balance in the tech policy world. Okay. All right. Good to know that is not the thing that is opening your eyes and making you go. I appreciate you sharing that. I'm one of these folks too. Like, one of the first things I'm in the morning is like, all right, let me read through my, you know, 3 to 4 different newspapers that I feel like my dad, who used to wake up every morning with like the hard newspaper with his cup of coffee and be like, let's see what's happening in the news, right? But like, you know, it's still an interesting part of life. But I think now we do so much of that through, you know, social or through RSS feeds or through the, you know, the various digital ways that we can. You mentioned moving from X to Blue Sky. So many people have made that move. Can you tell me a little bit about your exodus journey, transition, whatever we want to call it?
Well, you know, I left actually the day Musk acquired it.
Okay.
Headquarters with the toilet.
With this.
Or the sink. The sink. Yeah.
A toilet might have been.
I wonder what I thought it was, a toilet.
It's always going to be a toilet in my head from here on out.
I didn't just, like, it was an actual slip up, right? But yeah. I knew it was a sink, really. I left that day.
Yeah.
I wrote an article with a dear friend and like brilliant colleague, Kashana Gray. we wrote a piece in Wired, and I believe the title was Digital Migration is Nothing New for Black Folks.
Yeah. Okay, tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, and I just explained that, you know, I don't think I had any special insight, but I knew it would become what it has become, that it exists to amplify right-wing narratives and, you know, poison our information sphere. Now, it happened a little differently than I anticipated, but that's what was going to happen. And so I could not in good conscience stay on there. But also, I think even to this day, there are debates about whether or not people should be on there, which I think kind of fundamentally misunderstand how it works now, you know?
Tell me more.
And what I mean by that is, like, I owe a ton of my notoriety to being on there for a certain moment in time. You know, it's how people, some people know who I am and how some of my ideas got out there and things like that. You know, I wound up testifying before Congress because someone knew my work from Twitter.
Yeah.
So there was a time when it really drove the narratives, particularly in media. It had a very outsized influence in the ideas that were put into the public sphere.
Yeah.
That may or may not still be true, but it's mainly true to the extent that those narratives are right wing. I think because of the way that it's been altered, you know, tweaked, that gaining notoriety for, you know, sort of leftist or progressive ideas, you know, is not really a thing on there like it used to be. I think people who argue that you should stay on there don't understand that very well. And yeah, I feel weird saying this to you, right? I mean,
it's for the audience.
Like, I'm like,
okay, on the choir that you're preaching to, you know, the audience.
I mean, hopefully I'm representing it accurately, you know, but like, I'm not the expert on that in this conversation. But, you know, and so I it was obvious that that's what it was going to happen. And so I left. Now I wound up on Blue Sky. Again, like all social media, it has its problems, you know, but I think, and it, you know, it does not have the reach at all that Twitter did. But I think it is a better alternative for the moment.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you talking to us a little bit through that while you were talking about that. I think that this is true. Let's say this. You were talking a little bit about, you know, the progressive leftist ideas kind of being able to have a voice and a notoriety and a sort of outsized influence at a point in Twitter. And, you know, that wasn't always the case, right? And I think a lot of the work that I ended up doing was thinking about, you know, shifting power balances and thinking about, you know, whose voices were being amplified, especially by the algorithm of the platform. I'm pretty sure that you were one of the folks that I worked with to get verified in the
absolutely
campaigns.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I like my brain is like, you know, I've blocked out. I have blocked out a good amount of that. I think that was the year was 2020, and I have blocked out a good amount of what happened in the Bird app between 2020 and 2021. But yes, I appreciate you talking a little bit about that, because that was work that, you know, so many of us inside of the company, we're sitting around looking and seeing, we're saying, like, whose voices are actually being amplified here, right? And why is it only, you know, very often the white men who happen to know somebody who works here and not necessarily the folks who, you know, have the ability to write an article that says something like digital migration is nothing new for Black people, right?
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, it's how I testified before Congress. It's how I was able to write for Wired and The Atlantic. It's how I was able to, you know, talk about video doorbells on NBC. I mean, a lot of that came from that exposure.
Well, shout out to everybody at Twitter who worked on those various campaigns. I think, you know, there was a lot of work that was done that I think, you know, we kind of see the fruit of in the world that we don't necessarily think about while we were sitting there doing that. So I appreciate that. But
it was incredible. Like it was, you know, absolutely imperative to me sitting here right now, actually.
Well, I'm glad that you're sitting here right now, and I'm glad that you are talking to me and talking to us about privacy. And I know that we've been sitting here talking a lot about, you know, this idea of privacy. And I want to talk a little bit about your work and get into some things that you have done. But I want to ask you just generally, like, what does privacy actually mean to you, or how would you define it?
Yeah. You know, like, I rarely get asked this question.
Really?
Yeah. And so I reached out to a friend of mine who's also a surveillance scholar, Sava Sahili Singh. And I was like, oh, I know this is a bad question, you know, but like, how would you define privacy? You know, because there's like, sometimes you just, well, I mean, one of the things Sava's so good at is like putting things very concisely, you know, and I'm sure I could have come up with a definition, right? Like, I mean, it's what I do,
right.
But like, I took her definition because it was so good.
Okay, share it with us. Share the
definition. Yeah, and so this is what she said. Okay. The right and agency of a person or community should have to reasonably avoid, evade scrutiny, be it of their body, data, or property.
So the right to avoid scrutiny.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, tell me, how did you become interested or become kind of focused on this thing called privacy, or this right to avoid scrutiny?
Well, you know, I think there's a couple different ways I can think about that. You know, part of it is that I was growing up Black in Detroit, you know, I mean, when we think about Simone Brown, you know, I have her book, Dark Matters, right in front of me.
I mean, the classic.
Yeah.
The canon, I should say.
Right. Now, I mean, I didn't know her work when I was like a kid growing up in Detroit, but the way she talks about anti-Blackness being at the root of surveillance and carceral technologies, you know, I think even as a kid, I kind of understood some of that, right? Like, it might not even be fair to say I understood it, but I felt it. You know, I talk a lot about, you know, I talk about this in the book, and I've used this example a ton of times. I apologize for people who've heard it before, but
they can hear it again.
I think about the advent of electronic locks,
okay,
you know, and walking down the street as a kid in the city. And although I've come to find out that electronic locks first came out in like the 1910s or 1912,
something
like that, the first car that had them. But like, I think that they sort of started to mass appear in cars in the 70s.
Okay.
And, you know, so lots of Black people I know have had the experience of walking down the street and hearing someone lock their car.
Locking the door.
Before cars were made to, this is before they were made to automatically lock when you shifted into drive.
Right.
You know? And that experience of sort of being, of that like click, being sort of a audible representation of how you were viewed. And this is when I'm a child, right?
Like, right, yeah.
Of being a representation of how you're viewed, you know, it always stood out to me. I always kind of felt that, you know, I came up in Detroit shortly after the disbandment of a vice group called Stress, which stood for Stop the Robberies, Enjoy Safe Streets.
Ooh.
Yeah. Which was this like,
what an
really
acronym,
brutal vice unit in Detroit that wound up killing, I think in a very short span of time, 13 people,
wow.
12 of whom were Black,
wow.
You know, and yeah. Part of like a big part of that was like kind of the surveillance of communities, you know, Black communities in the city. Also wound up like part of what wound up taking them down as a Black woman, forensic scientist. It's like a really interesting story.
But there's a documentary about this.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. I'm like, I love a documentary. I'm like, I'm seeing this. Yes. Okay.
There's a podcast about it too, which is
okay.
Amazing. Yeah. And so part of it is that, you know, but you know, again, like part of my origin story, I think, is coming to social media, coming to Twitter, and finding like really incredible scholars who are having these discussions. You know, Frank Pasquale always stands out as someone, you know, that in the early days when I was just like on these platforms, I was like, oh my God, these people are so smart. Like Simone Brown, I mentioned, Cynthia Noble, like to seeing the work that they were doing and talking about this stuff, you know, was really inspiring. And I think thirdly, it was my teaching. I was at the college where I was at the time, they were doing some really shady stuff with filtering the internet, which required me to learn a lot about sort of how that happens, why that happens, you know, how tech companies were surveilling people, all those things, how, what kinds of decisions went into who gets what kind of information, you know, what kinds of information goes out about you, like all these things. Because, like, in short, my students weren't able to do research for the kinds of research I thought they should be able to do on campus because the internet was filtered.
Wow.
And I sort of started a campaign against my school at the time to try and get them to reverse that policy. So I think those three things, those are part of the story I think is important in terms of like how I started to think about this stuff.
Yeah, your origin story. So you mentioned something about that moment I feel so visceral of walking down the street and hearing the click, right? And the doors locking. You mentioned that you felt that. What did it feel like to be in that moment?
You know, it feels like being watched, you know, and it is often, so it was never someone from the neighborhood. And that's the other thing that I think is really important. It was never someone, it was never my neighbor.
Okay.
You know, it was someone who was there for some other reason, or it was someone who was getting from going from point A to point B, but wasn't from around here, you know? And so it was like, it feels like a sign that I'm the one who's not supposed to be there, even though it's my neighborhood, you know?
Yeah.
It feels alienating. It feels insulting, you know? And, you know, I mean, one of the jokes I make is that often people would do this even when their windows were down. It's like, look, if I'm going to, like, you know, smash you out of the car, right?
that's not going to solve the problem.
Yeah. But, you know, I mean, I think I think it's a good sort of icon, right, for the ways that technologies, you know, particularly surveillance technologies, and I know a lot of people will not think of an electronic lock as something in that category, but I think it's a good, you know, it's good, a good symbol for how these technologies can like alienate us in our own neighborhoods and in places where that we have every right to be.
Thank you for sharing that and being articulating that sort of feeling for me and for the listeners. I want to talk a little bit more about the work that you've been able to do, because I mentioned, I think when we were doing the intro, that you really have shaped a lot of the way that we talk about many different things in tech policy. You've coined some of the terms that we've used. One of them, for instance, of course, as you know, is digital redlining. Would you mind just kind of sharing for folks who, for some reason, might have no idea what that means?
Yeah. I did not invent it. I think even, I'm pretty sure Jathan Sadowski and Astra Taylor did an article before my piece came out that used the term, but I did help popularize it, you know, and where it came from is, you know, the instance I just mentioned where I was teaching and my students weren't able to do research because the internet was filtered, you know, and for those who don't know, I taught at a community college in suburban Detroit. A lot of my students did not have internet at home, you know, or we're working multiple jobs and things like that. We're in situations where when they were on campus was when they were able to do their work. And for people who don't know a lot about how filtering works, traditionally the one of the problems with it, sort of like just on a sort of technical level, is that it lets in things that you know, if you're trying to keep things out, it lets them in anyway. You know, if the person is dedicated enough.
Right.
But it also but it also keeps out things that, you know, would be kind of legitimate arenas of inquiry. Now, for my taste on a college, almost everything's a legitimate arena of inquiry, right? But I'm talking about from the perspective of someone who's installing or maintaining a filter.
Yeah.
So it would keep out elements of the Bible, right? It would keep out, you know, a June Jordan poem or an E.E. Cummings poem,
wow,
you know, things like that. if there were, you know, Playboy used to do interviews of like
great interviews, players,
right?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, it did. Like, you know, there's an interview of Jimmy Carter in Playboy.
Yeah.
You couldn't get it because of the filter. And so I started thinking about that, not only in terms of sort of what my students were not able to access, but what were the sort of class and race implications of that?
Mm.
As someone from Detroit, you know, who's very clued into what redlining meant, not only in the, you know, 40s and 50s, but like the remnants of that now, right? Like I grew up 2 miles away from 8 Mile, you know, where you could see the very strong distinction between an area where investments and loans were like allowed and encouraged, and on the other side of the street, they were not.
They weren't,
You know, and then later on in my life, I lived in another city or another kind of suburb, Grosse Pointe, where we could see the same things, right?
Yeah.
The more I came to understand the implications of this were drawn along not only class and race lines in terms of like digital, right? But they also kind of mirrored the exact geographies that we tend to see, right? That, you know, I remember, I don't know if I've told this story before, but I once lived in a loft downtown. And the ISP said that I could not, like broadband wasn't available to me from where I lived. And it was only a couple of like a matter of like the telephone pole being a couple feet this way or a couple feet that way.
Wow.
To get broadband. Now, I mean, I was able to like a little bit kind of socially engineer and get the guy to give me broadband, you know?
Right.
But everybody is not able to do that.
Right.
And we've seen that educational outcomes, health outcomes, you know, political outcomes can all be connected to, you know, there's a strong connection between whether or not some of those things are positive or negative in people's ability to access information on the internet.
Right.
I began speaking and writing about that as digital redlining.
Well, the thing that you have been talking a lot about recently, and I know that you're writing a book about, is luxury surveillance. Could you tell us a little bit about what that is and tell us a little bit about your book that you're working on?
Yeah. So this came about when the basic root of it is that I argue that an ankle monitor and an Apple Watch are essentially the same technology. Oh my God, you're right.
I'm wearing an Apple Watch, and I will tell you, when I got this Apple Watch because I, you know, was trying to be healthy or some shit, and I literally got it and told my best friend, and her response was, "I didn't think we were allowed to do that." And I was like, screw you. Yes.
Yeah.
Anyways, as you're saying, my own, yes. My
car, they are essentially the same thing. And that we can really understand some of the things that tech companies are up to when we tease out those parallels. That there's a segment of devices often chosen by people who have the ability, you know, to say yes to surveillance, where they think that they are likely to gain some benefits, accrue some benefits, and they don't understand them as surveillance devices. And that ultimately a big part of this is helping to normalize surveillance for all of us.
Yeah.
By the fact that people embrace these technologies and understand them as aspirational.
Yeah. Is there any particular, I mean, you mentioned the Apple Watch, which again is, I just feel like I should have taken it off before I talked to you. Is there any piece of technology that really just like pushes the button or like really irks you out there? Like that really luxury surveillance technology?
Yeah. I mean, the big one now are the video glasses, whether it's the Meta Ray-Bans or, you know, what have you. But also like all the wearables that are coming out that are stuffed with Gen AI. You know, video doorbells, who are the, I've hated those since the beginning, right?
Yeah.
I think those are also hugely detrimental to society. But the one that sort of pokes me the most in the worst way at this moment would be glasses with Yeah, video glasses.
The glasses of those ones. I mean, I think it's really fascinating that we basically brought back Google Glass. But I thought we had shamed people away from it.
Yeah, we can again, right?
Yeah, I think that piece of shame. So I would love to talk to you a little bit. I know that you describe yourself as an abolitionist, right? And I think that there is something there. Would you describe or tell us what that means, especially in the tech policy space?
Yeah, I mean, I'm of the firm belief that many of these technologies should not exist. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, we should reject them in any and all ways possible and available mm-hmm. to us. You know, I know that some people don't consider that practical. And, you know, it would be okay. But, I think that the negative social impacts of these technologies have already been well established. I mean, look around. And so, and one of the parts of pushback I often get is talking about their sort of legitimate use cases, right? Mm-hmm. I think for some of these technologies, there is not a legitimate use case. Or at the very least, for something like the Meta Ray-Bans. I mean,
yeah.
A big part of the reason they exist, I would argue the main reason they exist, is to normalize sort of ever-present surveillance and lower the barrier for all kinds of harassment and antisocial behavior. Mm. Now, people can use them for other things, you know?
Right, like, right. Like what? I mean,
yeah. Well, you know, I like somebody on social media the other day was like, I use it to like, do this thing, you know, and it's like, look, OK, sure. You know, you can use your AK as a doorstop, right? That's not what it's for, you know, but it's not what it's for. Like, I, you
know, it's not what they made that for.
And so, yeah, I think we should reject these things. No, again, there's ways. I've talked about this before. There's a lot of investment in making sure that we're not able to, you know. Yeah. So, for instance, Amazon is also coming out with a eyewear for workers.
Oh, wonderful!
And they mostly, I imagine, will not be able to say no to these, you know. Mm-hmm. And this is why I kind of came up with that formulation of luxury surveillance. Is that I don't think people, when I would talk about these things. You know, a lot of times, if you bring up how it harms marginalized people, how it is used to target Black and brown folks, trans mm-hmm. people, you know, people seeking reproductive care, people would often invoke some kind of the sort of nothing to hide argument or right. say that it didn't affect them or things like that. Right. Now, I'd love to live in a society where it was, you know, if you said like it harms this segment of people. Then people's response wouldn't be, well, but I still need to get my packages or whatever.
Right. Like, who cares?
I would love for that to be true. Yeah. Unfortunately, it's like, in my experience, mostly not. Yeah. And so part of what I have set out to do or what I hope some of my projects do is show people that the negative effects of these things are not isolated to the most vulnerable. Now, they do, it's true that they hit them the hardest, the earliest, the most often, you right. know, but they eventually come for everyone.
It's also coming for you.
Yeah. Right. And also the supposed benefits of these things are highly overrated.
Oh, right. I mean, yeah. Like Apple Watch for health, right? Like, okay.
Yeah. Right. Like it's not, you know, like just go for your walk, right? Just lift weights, like just, you know, go to bed on time. Like you'll be fine. Right. Like most of us will.
Right. I mean, I don't know that we all need to see our sleep categorized into colors and broken down by the minute and the thing.
That, yeah.
I look at it. I'm like, I was definitely not asleep. You know what I mean? Like I was awake. So like, you're wrong. Right. So it is. you are so right in that. And you mentioned this piece that I think is so fascinating around tech that just like simply shouldn't exist. Right. And the way that we should reject these things. I was reading the Washington Post article that you were talking about, and you said no one would look at asbestos and say we can't outlaw chemistry, but they look at facial recognition and say you can't outlaw math. And I thought that was it, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, recently, and I apologize because I don't have the quote in front of me. But, you know, Emily Bender said something. She doesn't use the term Gen AI. I forget the term she uses, but she was talking about what we understand or was like kind of commonly called Gen AI.
Yeah.
And she referred to it or thought, you know, and in the piece that she wrote, she talked about it, said we should view it in the same way we view plastic.
Oh, right? Wow. Okay. Yeah.
That, you know, that an important thing would be to avoid it when we can, right? That if we had avoided it and understood the harms, right? Now there's, you know, now we all have microplastics in our bodies and it's the bottom of the ocean, right?
Right.
We had like a thought about it differently at the, you know, when it was becoming more, you know, prevalent, that we might be looking at a different landscape now. And so I think for particularly, I mean, this article was talking about Gen AI, but there are a lot of things that we've I use that term loosely, it's not exactly the right term, but the trajectory of a lot of these technologies has been established by companies who do not have our best interests at heart. And like, frankly, probably, you know, should be seen, like saying they do not have our best interests at heart is like the lightest touch I can say, right? They're openly oppressive and aligned with authoritarianism is probably a better way to say it.
Yeah. You know?
But we've let them set the terms for like what society should look like and what technologies are out in the open and in the world. I would argue that the result of that has not been positive.
Yeah.
And that some of these things, I think, we should say like they should not exist. You know, a good friend of mine, David Columbia, before he passed away, wrote an article called ChatGPT Should Not Exist.
Yeah.
Now, this was like 3 years ago, right? This is like shortly after like the initial version of chat was launched. Got a lot of pushback on that.
Yeah.
A lot of negative feedback. It's turned out to be like the right call.
Yeah.
And I think we should like be, you know, more openly articulate that when that's the case, right?
Yeah.
I was talking to another friend who was reading Joseph Weizenbaum's, and I forget the name of his work, but really one of his early books, where he talks about the negative effects of some of these technologies and like how we can and should respond to them. And I think what's the right way to say this? I think a lot of people have been force fed this notion of innovation that serves like the best interests of the tech companies that say they should be able to do whatever they want, cause whatever harms they want.
Right.
And that, you know, doing and not letting them do that is somehow bad for society. Yeah, I don't think the results of that have worked out very well for us in the last couple decades, certainly.
Yeah, hard agree. And question for you, do you use ChatGPT? Do you use Gen AI at all?
I have never. So the short answer is no. Right.
For you.
If you pulled up like the website or the app or whatever, like I don't even know what it looks like. You could tell me, you know.
Yeah.
Like I would have no idea. It's never been on my computer. Right. Now, you know, someone listening is gonna be like, well, there's Gen AI in your phone, you know.
Right.
Correct or whatever it is.
But like, you've never gone to ChatGPT and been like, tell me about myself.
Yeah. I never will. I never have it, I never will.
Okay. I love that because I think that there is such a world in which, you know, working in academia, there's just this like everybody's using AI, therefore we have to adopt it, right? We have to figure it out. And you remind me so much of my friend's mom the other day when we were talking about ChatGPT, and their response was, chat who, right? Like what? What is this thing that we are talking about? And so there is definitely still a way to resist, as you're talking about, and to believe in this piece of abolition. I'd love to talk a little bit about the future and what you're thinking, what you're seeing. One of the questions I have for you is, what are the sort of biggest disparities in the realm of privacy that you are seeing right now today?
Yeah. Can I go back for 1 second?
Please. Of course.
Yeah.
All the time.
So, you know, I was talking, you know, another part of my origin story, right? Or another thing I think is so interesting or about how people have come to embrace this tech. There's a study, I think out of U of M, that talked about how marginalized and minoritized people were much less likely to sort of trust Gen AI. You know, I've been thinking a lot about, you know, and at some point I hope to write something, and Damian Williams and I have been talking about it online. Because, you know, I think about sort of the history of literacy, as I understand it, like not only in my own journey, but like in terms of like Blackness, right? That there very recently, right? I could not go to the library and take out a book, right? Like not me personally, but someone.
Right.
Who,
right.
You know,
that ancestors.
Was,
yeah.
Yeah. Illegal to take, to teach people, Black people, to read, things like that. That is in like recent memory. And now these billionaires and, you know, soon to be trillionaires in some cases have come along and said, oh, we have a thing that's going to make it so that you don't have to read it. Right? We have a thing that will give you the answer.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't, I think it's such a weird, I'm a little bit surprised at the extent to which academics have embraced it. I mean, I understand from the point of administrators, academics, all kinds of people who, you know, thinking and being creative.
And writing. Reading and writing.
Yeah. Right. And I, you know, I can't help but think about it just in terms of like the struggles for literacy that have been, you know, that were very bloody, right? And and pronounced just to be able to like read.
You know?
And now like
a
bunch of a small cadre of super rich people are telling you you don't need it anymore. And
you don't need it.
No, I'm not doing that.
They have all the money, therefore we don't need to read.
Yeah. Yeah. Like we have the machine that'll give you the one answer. Like,
no, I don't think so.
Right. I read that story before. It doesn't work.
That is, I thank you for bringing us back to talk about that, because I think that that is a really great point that you're making, especially the, we've read that book before. Right. And we're living in the future of the books that warned us about our present, which feels a little fascinating. Okay. So the biggest disparity in the realm of privacy that you see, what's going on?
I mean, I think Gen AI is a good kind of use case or example of that, right? That often it's not understood or talked about as a surveillance mechanism.
Yeah, it's not.
You know, I mean, I think a lot about what Meredith Whitaker was talking about when, you know, people are talking about agentic AI, right? And things like that, right? Now, I don't know, like, how much it works, like, or if it'll ever kind of fully work or anything like that. I have some questions, right? I have some skeptics. But if it were to work, the extent to which it would surveil you is, like, unprecedented. You know, I think a big part of what companies, so I have this kind of model or whatever that I'm working on for the book. And I think there have been sort of like three different kind of important eras, for lack of a better term, in terms of like, sort of like algorithms and what people say their algorithms are going to do and things like that. But also what tech companies promise they're going to do. That the deal that they used to offer is, we'll give you this service, you know, give you, and to pay for it, you let us surveil you a little bit, you know, that
Facebook model.
Facebook, you know, like when we people would say, well, Mark, why can't we just pay for a Facebook where you're not surveilled? Right? No, like, thanks. No. Right?
That's the whole point.
Right. That now that deal was a lie, you know, like the level of surveillance that people that is deployed against people. Like, you know, the data broker system, like, say to someone, like, you know, there are data brokers who, you know, have categories like parents whose child just died of cancer. Things like that. Like, a lot of people don't know that. Like, the extent of that surveillance, right? Facebook pixels on your, you know, on your, at your doctor's office, on the website and things like that. So that deal was sort of always a lie, right? But how they've tried to alter that deal, I think, is really important in that now the wave of Gen AI promises you all these things, but the only way, like the surveillance has now become the thing, right? The surveillance is the benefit, that if you let these devices watch you sleep, you know, listen to you talk to your partner, record you on your way to and from things, like all these things, that it will help you optimize your life, you know, that pervasive and always on surveillance will somehow like benefit you in kind of untold ways. Now, you asked about the disparity, right? Now, I think there's going to be a lot of ways that there are going to be some people who like want and like these things, right?
Yeah.
Like, unfortunately, like I used to say, who wants this? And it seems like there are people who want it.
There's a market somewhere.
Yeah. But there are also people who will not be able to say no, right?
Yeah.
That,
yeah,
you know, like they're starting to, you know, Axon has the product of body cams for retail workers and hospital workers.
Wow.
As I mentioned, Amazon's coming out with, you know, smart glasses, you know, surveillance glasses for workers, you know, that more and more there'll be kind of a segment of the population who is forced to endure, you know, a degree of this surveillance, not only in their working lives, right? But then they'll come home or whatever, and that'll be part of their life as well. You know, I think that that's where some of the disparity is going to come from. That, and again, like, I think that as this becomes normalized, right? And I don't want this to be the future, right? Like, I hope that this is not the future. I think the current trajectory kind of lends itself to that. That as it becomes normalized, right? Like, you know, we started talking about this from the very beginning, that I've seen, unfortunately, that people are kind of adopting and accepting of these things with the belief that it will benefit them some way. And again, this is apart from when it's enforced on people for work, for school, you know, as conditions for employment or benefits or whatever the case may be.
I think,
and again, part of like what Gen AI sort of promises, like, again, whether it can deliver, is that all this data, you know, is that something will be watching it and parsing it, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Where in the past, like, you know, there's like untold hours of body cam footage that's never been watched, right? A human can't, you know, they're not going to dedicate the resources for a human.
Right.
But like, the promise, you know, in quotation marks, right, of Gen AI is that, allow all that stuff to be watched and parsed somewhere or another.
Yeah,
that's a long explain. There's a long.
No. I appreciate you. I you mentioned, you know, the Axon sort of cameras for retail workers, and it struck me because I remember, was it like 10 years ago? He was working on policies for Axon body cameras for police officers, right? And so thinking about how the policies for these things that we wrote in such a different context are now streaming down to, you know, everyday folks is something that I think is fascinating. And so you mentioned something that is not your hope for the future, but I have one last question for you, which is actually, what is your hope for the future of privacy and what it could look like for all of us?
Yeah. I mean, so, you know, I always think a lot about Ruha Benjamin, you know, who talks
me
about,
too.
Yeah, everyone should, right?
Right. Especially in this space. I think that's a good place to start.
Yeah. You know, I mean, who talks like a lot about imagination and kind of the future we are living in, you know? You know, I think, you know, like, I hate to say what I'm about to say, but because I'm not going to phrase it the right way, right? I think a lot of times people are like, well, I'm not a Luddite, right? Which is like not true. I would actually probably be better categorized as one. I do like technology, right? Like, I do. I think that it is possible to have some of these things, but that don't, you know, like, but I mean, we'd have to have them sort of divorced from capitalism, right? Like, I mean, I have a phrase that I say often, right? Which is like, every future imagined by a tech company is worse than the previous iteration.
Yes. Yes. This is, that is on t-shirts, on stickers, yeah, on everything. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think I need to do another t-shirt drop, right?
Yes. Like, I think you do too.
And the reason I say that is because the imagination of the tech company is driven by capitalism and the need to like extract maximum value from us. That in order for these things to exist in a way that didn't do that and actually benefited us, you know, we kind of have to rewrite a bunch of the ways that things work. I think that's possible. You know, I think it is. It's like actually super dark right now, you know, but, you know, I was just talking to a collection of college students. And, you know, I think in a lot of ways, like the tech barons are really overplaying their hand. And what I mean by that is that it's very clear where their alliances are. Mm-hmm. Like there's not really kind of any pretense anymore, you know, whose side they're on, whether they believe in things like, you know, racial justice or equity or even democracy. Like we don't, like, I don't have that question anymore.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Like, yeah. I personally never did, but you know, like
some people did. Yeah.
Yeah. It's very obvious where they are.
Yeah. Like,
you know, history says that usually doesn't work out well for that crew of people, you know? And so I think that there, it's possible to have some of these things in ways that don't feed directly into authoritarianism. You know, I mean, yeah. Again, like I think some of them like should not exist.
Right.
But like if you wanted a device, right, that, you know, you thought helped you better kind of stick to your fitness goals, that didn't send that to a company that then sends it to an authoritarian like government, like,
right,
nice, you know,
that it would be that'd be ideal, right?
Yeah,
you know. Dream.
And so there's going to have to be like a sort of reckoning with like where we are.
Yeah,
that I think is, I do think it's more and more common that people understand some of these things, right? Yeah. That pushback, you know, like I've been talking about luxury surveillance maybe 10 years, you know? Yeah. And when I initially said like, oh, like this thing's like a ankle monitor, you know, people were scandalized that would make such like a comparison. And like nobody fights me on it anymore.
Yeah. You know?
Like, they're like, oh, yeah, I kind of see that, right?
Yeah.
But it's,
yeah,
like, it's clear what the imperatives and impulses of these companies are.
Yeah.
And so as I think more and more people understand that, I think more and more pushback is inevitable.
Well, I agree with you. I hope that we have that pushback that comes. And I want to reiterate something that you said, that we can rewrite the ways that things work and that it is possible. And so I appreciate you, Chris, for joining us on this podcast as we think about, you know, the ways that we are able to rewrite these things, the way that we can think about the way that privacy can be possible for all of us together in the future. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
That's it for this episode. I hope you'll send your feedback. You can write to me at justin@techpolicy.press. Thanks to Anika, thanks to my co-founder, Brian Jones, and thank you for listening.
Tech Policy Press.